Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. We have on our show with us today a very special guest, Dr. Angus Manoush, professor of philosophy at Concordia University in Maquon, Wisconsin. And he's going to talk to us today about some of the work that he has done in the debate over intelligent design and evolution. So, Dr. Manoush, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
First of all, I'd like to know if you could tell us a little bit about your academic background.
Yeah, I did my undergraduate degree in philosophy at the University of Warwick in England, and then I did a PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was very interested in philosophy of mind, artificial intelligence, and logic at the time. So I did my doctorate on action explanation, how can an agent's reasons explain his action. And I've come to see that that's a fundamental problem for materialism, because reasons include goals, but materialism doesn't recognize goal-directed causes.
So did your doctoral research have implications also for criminal law and criminal intent and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I suppose that it did. I mean, to the extent that I was defending a robust idea that people really do act for reasons, which interestingly enough is attacked by materialists in the philosophy of mind. They can't find room for reasons.
That's absolutely true. You know, when I took criminal law in law school, just as a little interlude here, I was always struck at how it was assumed that there were real mental, you know, there was real mental causation going in the minds of human beings who were being tried in criminal cases. And almost a very non-materialistic account of the mind forms the base assumption for our legal system in many ways.
It does. Yeah, the whole idea of motive and responsibility assumes that you can identify agents' reasons for their actions.
That's absolutely true. I would be loath to think what would happen if our legal system actually started to behave as if we were purely, you know, material meat computers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, although sometimes you do see that with cases of diminished responsibility that in effect do try to use the environment or drugs or anything else as a way out.
That is very true. Well, that's a conversation for another day. Maybe one we could have. Definitely a very interesting one. What I want to know is, how did you get involved in the debate over intelligent design and evolution? What first got you interested in the debate, and then how did you get involved with it?
Well, basically by hosting a conference at my university in 2000 called Design and Its Critics, and we gave equal time to the defenders of Darwinism and to critics from the intelligent design movement. And so, you know, after going through that, I started reading around in the literature on both sides, and I noticed that this central debate on design is so closely related to my own area of interest. It's really just the same question: is goal-directed causation possible or not? Same issue in the philosophy of mind as in ID. And it's fascinating that so many philosophers would, and other thinkers would grant that you have goal-directed causation when it's human beings, and yet they would be completely hostile to ID.
Wow, that's amazing. So what then made you a Darwin skeptic? What made you become a skeptic of Darwinian evolution?
I guess three main reasons. First, that if goal-directed causation is the only reasonable account of human rationality, then we already know of a case where it works. So it's got to be an empirical question if there is non-human goal-directed causation going on in nature. So I realized that, you know, this is a legitimate scientific question, and people don't have any problem with it if they think it's aliens or machines that might be intelligent. They just get nervous if the agency might possibly be supernatural, as the fine-tuning argument suggests. So that was one issue. Another one was my experience in computer science. I've taught computer programming for 17 years, and anyone in that area can tell you that the kind of changes that Darwinism suggests, local, small changes are not capable of coordinating large complex solutions effectively. It doesn't work when you do this to sophisticated computer programs, so why should it work in the case of biological machines? And a third reason, I guess, is that Darwinism seems to have become a politically protected sacred cow, and, you know, I've never seen a sacred cow I haven't wanted to roast. I think that, you know, the fact that you're not supposed to criticize it is just too irresistible for me.
Of course, no offense intended to any of our Hindu listeners, but I can appreciate your desire to ask, you know, questions that the intelligentsia maybe don't want you to ask. I think those are sometimes the most important questions to ask. You know, Dr. Manoj, one of the things I studied quite a bit in law school was environmental law. And of course, when you're dealing with environmental law, one of the questions that always comes up is this particular pollution or this particular environmental problem, was it caused by humans? Was it caused by a corporation? Or was it caused by purely natural processes, in which case no human being is culpable for the damage that was done to the environment? And it's just, again, so striking that our legal system assumes that, of course, intelligent agents can cause problems. And, you know, the whole field of environmental law and environmental science as a whole is focused on studying, you know, the actions of human intelligent agents. And it's just so amazing how in that field, it's okay to talk about intelligent causation, but not in other fields. Have you ever thought about that?
Well, yeah, and the same thing with proper practice in science. I mean, when somebody detects plagiarism, or that a scientist fudged his statistics or didn't do the experiment correctly, the tests that we use to figure those things out assume that we can identify intelligent causes. So they're in the background of science all the time. The whole experimental method talks about the design of experiments. And it seems odd that I think that we've become bewitched by the object of our studies, because we spend so much time looking at machines and things, we become less interested in, you know, what's going on in people's minds when they design experiments and things like that.
So do you think that intelligent design is a real scientific theory?
What I'd prefer to say is design is more of a scientific research program. It's a very broad idea, but that within that you can propose lots of different scientific theories by generating more specific testable models. So I think scientific materialism, that's not a scientific theory, it's a research program. And an idea is a competing research program, but I wouldn't say it's a specific theory.
So in 2004, you authored a wonderful book titled Agents Under Fire, Materialism and the Rationality of Science, a book that I would highly recommend to our listeners. But can you explain to them, what is your book about?
Basically, it was an attempt to show that scientific materialism can't be identified with science because, to put it in its simplest terms, scientific materialism is incompatible with the rationality of the scientist. If you want to have an account of all of science that makes sense, it's got to accommodate the rationality of the scientists themselves. Otherwise, you can't go around trying to commend this worldview on the basis of reason. And when you look at scientific materialist accounts of human beings, you find either that they eliminate important categories of agency, such as consciousness or intentionality, or they try to identify them with part of nature or reduce them some way. And it never works, because they always end up replacing rational causes with non-rational causes. The non-rational causes end up doing all the work. And this is actually very closely connected, by the way, to a point that C.S. Lewis made in his book Miracles, in which Victor Rappert has since developed as the argument from reason, which shows that scientific materialism undermines the whole idea of human reasoning, and hence undermines, of course, any good reason to accept it.
Now, how would you respond to the objection from the Darwinist who says that, well, natural selection, you know, the requirements for survival would dictate that we need the ability to think logically and we need the ability to accurately assess the world around us and think things through in a factually realistic manner, and therefore evolution can provide an account of the origin of logic. How would you respond to an argument like that?
Well, evolution will get you something much more modest. It will get you useful gadgets and strategies that work, but that won't get you this connection to objective truth. I mean, if somebody thinks deductively and correctly, they can reach conclusions that are necessarily true. But on the Darwinian view, all you need is local rules that work in order to survive. And so you get useful models, but you don't really get truth. Mm. This is the whole idea, of course, that Alvin Plantinger has developed.
Mm. And of course, you know, some Darwinists would actually agree with you. Like Michael Shermer says that we evolved this belief engine that gives us belief systems that help us, you know, to survive. And of course, that's a underhanded jab for him at religion, because he says that, you know, religion may have been at one time a useful adaptation, but now it just, you know, we have these mental neural programs that produce false beliefs in people.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is that in a sense, Michael Shermer, if he's going to be fair, has just undermined his own argument, because, you know, how does he not know that atheism is another false belief engine product, and rather than religion being the true one, or something along those lines? So it really becomes very arbitrary when you really think of what evolutionists are saying about, you know, the way our mind works.
Yeah, they're throwing a universal acid selectively, which is a contradiction. The arguments that they're using will undermine every view. This is the point that, you know, Alistair McGrath made so beautifully in his recent book about Richard Dawkins.
Mm. Very, very good. Very, very good. Well, in your book, you also discuss what is necessary for a Darwinian account of the evolution of irreducibly complex systems, and you specifically use the example of the bacterial flagellum. Could you summarize for us what Darwinists must produce in order to explain the origin of biological machines like the flagellum in evolutionary terms? And could you also tell me, have they produced such a complete explanation yet?
Yeah, basically what I come up with is five conditions that any account must meet. In developing the system, it's got three main parts, the paddle, rotor, and motor, and then they're assembled from many proteins. But you need to have all those parts available. You need to have them available at the same time. You need to have them available at the same construction site, the same place. Then you have to coordinate their assembly, which uses a very sophisticated control program, and you have to make sure that the individual parts have a compatible interface, which is very important with proteins because of their specific three-dimensional geometry. It's kind of hand in glove how one protein will match with will bind with another one. And all of that, on a Darwinian view, would have to be explained in a gradual, stepwise fashion. And I think all of them are problems, but I think that the hardest problems for the Darwinian account are going to be coordination and interface compatibility. I like the way that Behe puts it in his recent book, Edge of Evolution. The problem with Darwinian changes is that they tend to accumulate independently and incoherently. Mm. You get a little change here, a little change there, but that's not going to develop two proteins that bind in the right way, or have parts that are just suited to fit together, and then also their construction has to follow a certain order. All of that seems to require the top-down organization that you expect from engineers and architects. Now, as far as their attempt to, you know, do this, the best they've come up with, people like Kenneth Miller and Alan Musgrave, is co-optation, the idea that maybe the flagellum co-opted a secretory apparatus called the type 3 secretory system. But it's well known there's lots of problems with this. I mean, Behe pointed out a problem in principle even before this was proposed. He said that these donated parts couldn't form a functioning system without extensive modification, and while this modification was going on, they'd be unable to work. Their previous functions make them ill-suited for virtually any new role as part of a complex system. Now, that's a quotation from Darwin's Black Box. Then you have the fact that this type 3 secretory system only gives you 10 of the proteins, and yet there's another 30. Where do they come from? And really the most important thing, though, is just having parts lying around doesn't solve the problem. You need to have a coordinated control program which orchestrates their assembly in sequence. And you don't get that just by having relevant protein parts. That's what Behe calls, you know, irreducible complexity squared. It's not just the complexity, it's the complexity of the program that builds the complex machine.
I definitely agree with you. I think that this is one of the beautiful things about the five steps that you mentioned that are required for the evolution of an irreducibly complex system. And unless you can explain the assembly of these, as you say, Behe calls it irreducible complexity squared, then you can't explain how these kinds of machines arise. And I think that these are very important points that the Darwinists really miss. I mean, they almost argue as if you were to take a box and put all the required parts for a computer in the box and shake it up, you know, maybe a little bit, put a little bit of Brownian motion in there, that somehow you're going to get a computer. And of course, I mean, that's not at all how machines work. That's not how machines, functional machines at least, get assembled. At the end of the day, you're going to be left with a box full of computer parts. So that's all you're going to have.
Yeah, basically it's a fallacy of composition that because all the parts work, therefore the whole works, but we all know that it's how you put the parts together is everything.
Yes. So, Dr. Manoj, based upon your experience as a computer programmer and a professor who teaches computer programming, what is the positive argument for design based upon, you know, your experience with what is necessary to, say, compose a computer program?
Well, basically, there's a strategy in computer programming used for any complex system called modular or top-down design. And the idea there is that it's virtually impossible to get a program to work correctly if you just look at each detail one after the other. What you have to do is you start at the top with your overall task. You break it down into several manageable modules below that. Then you break down those. And at each stage, you make sure you get the sequence in the right way. And then you discover really all the parts are discovered at the bottom. So you're starting from the top and ending up at the bottom. And using that strategy, people are able to develop enormously complex solutions that work because you can kind of procrastinate the details until you need to get them. If you try and work the other way and throw code from the bottom and hope that it forms something organized, it just doesn't work. Same thing with freshman essays thrown at the computer versus, you know, they finally learn that you have to actually plan your report if it's going to make any sense.
And same goes for programming, too. It definitely, you save yourself a lot of time if you create a pseudocode outline for a program and do it in a top-down kind of approach. That's for sure. Well, in your book, Agents Under Fire, you also talk a lot about the origin of the human mind. And we maybe have talked about this a little bit, but this goes along with my last question, I think, as well. Can evolutionary biology account for the level of integration necessary to produce human reason?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And again, it's because their approach is bottom-up. They try to suggest a collection of useful gadgets developed by our genes or the idea of memes, these discrete memorable units. And the idea is that somehow this builds up all the higher level psychological capacities, but it does it without there being any single supervisory self or I. They don't like that idea that there's top-down design, if you like, even in the mind. And, you know, one of the best, I think, arguments against that view is if you analyze people's ordinary practical reasoning, where they reason to a conclusion that's going to be an action, something they're going to do, you have to have top-down supervision. So an example I gave recently in a journal article, what if, suppose Alfonso takes voice lessons. Why does he do that? Well, the obvious explanation is that he takes voice lessons because he, Alfonso, desires Alfonso to become a great opera singer, and Alfonso believes that Alfonso's taking voice lessons will help Alfonso to become a great opera singer. Now, the reason for laboring the point that it's the same individual over and over again is if you break up the mind into all these different parts, and no one of them is the locus of this supervisory self, well, then you get a complete chaos. It'd be like this. Alfonso takes voice lessons because Martha, that's another module perhaps, desires Martha to become a great opera singer, and Jordan believes that Jordan's taking voice lessons will help Jordan to become a great opera singer. So if you try to sort of distribute yourself all over the place like that, you're going to get complete incoherence that won't explain why a single agent performs a single action. You get a kind of a Babel of the mind.
Mm. Well, I think this just shows how intelligent design reasoning is applicable in many different fields, not just, you know, traditional conversations about microbiological machines, but also in the function, in terms of the function of the mind. Intelligent design can also play a very active role there.
Right. I mean, I think it's, an overall paradigm, and that's why it has applications in any science, sociology, psychology. There's no end to it, and it's helpful to just rethink these disciplines and ask what would they look like from a design versus a Darwinian or materialistic point of view.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Manoj, for speaking with us today. Go check out Dr. Manoj's book, Agents Under Fire, Materialism and the Rationality of Science. It's a wonderful book. You'll get a very unique and compelling perspective on intelligent design. Thank you, Dr. Manoj, for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Well, this is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Bruce Chapman, president of Discovery Institute. The ID the Future podcast you just heard is a crucial part of the mission of the Center for Science and Culture, crucial to keeping you, our friends and supporters, informed about developments in the debate over intelligent design and evolution. Podcasts like Intelligent Design don't just come about through an unguided process or an unfunded process. That's why I'd like to ask you to help support us in whatever way you can. Please consider donating to Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture at discovery.org/CSC. You can also help support us by forwarding this podcast to family and friends and by posting links to intelligentdesign.org and discovery.org on your websites and homepages. Whatever you do, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.